Before I went to bed last night, I checked in on the weather situation from a cozy spot under a blanket in my warm house. The temperature outside had climbed to zero. When I woke up, it was something like 4, and that's the warmest it had been in the last 24 hours. There were times Tuesday night and into Wednesday when Kansas City was colder than Siberia. I won't lie, it's hard for me to imagine how someone survives that outdoors, with the risk of frostbite and hypothermia. But despite the homeless shelters and warming centers around town, that is absolutely a reality for some people. And last night, one of the coldest in recent memory just happened to be a regularly scheduled survey of Kansas City's homeless population. It's something called a point in time, and they do it once a year, specifically at a time when the people they encounter on, say, park benches are there because they truly have no other options. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today we're hearing what the Coalition to End Homelessness discovered in their research last night. I'm joined by Heather Hoffman. She's the executive director of the Kansas City Coalition to End Homelessness. Hi, Heather.
Hi, good morning.
Well, so can you start by explaining the whole point in time concept, what you do and why you do it?
Absolutely. So the point in time count is pretty much what it sounds like. It's essentially to serve as a snapshot to help us identify any given year how many folks are identifying as literally homeless and essentially living on the streets in our community, and then also to identify how many folks are staying in shelters at that time as well. It's something that HUD mandates that we do at least every other year, and our community chooses to do it around once a year. And this time frame that we do it in is also a HUD mandate in that it needs to be the last week of January.
Can you explain the HUD mandate part of it? Because that's intriguing to me that this is a mandated investigation.
Certainly. I love that term. I've not heard the term investigation used. That's an interesting one, and I like it. So HUD is one, of course, a primary funder of any agencies out there providing homeless services to our homeless neighbors. So as such, HUD wants to pull data from us in pretty much a myriad of ways. And this point in time count is simply one of many ways that HUD pulls that data to continue to get an understanding of how many folks in our community are indeed experiencing homelessness. So that's the purpose, is for us to have that snapshot in time.
How do you know where to look?
What a good question. Relationships, communication. We work with a lot of outreach teams who are building relationship with those folks who are experiencing literal homelessness, which then allows those outreach teams to reach out to those folks and ask them questions. And you, as you can imagine, walking up to a complete stranger with a clipboard in your hand saying, "Oh, tell me all about your personal life right now," it's not a very comfortable or a very natural thing. So finding folks, largely we rely on shelters, we rely on day centers and outreach teams who are helping to work with those folks on a daily basis.
So where did you go?
So we've hit so far, we've hit almost every warming shelter in the Kansas City area. And our particular COC covers the Jackson County side, but
COC.
Also... Thank you. Continuum of care. That is also a HUD-coined term. And it's just indicating the geographical group that HUD funds in that particular area.
Okay, so this is a 24-hour thing. It started at 3 p.m. yesterday, and it's going until 3 p.m. today.
Correct.
It started before sundown. It's still going on now. But I am interested, first of all, going into this, what were some of your concerns? What are some of the things you were worried you might find, like in a worst case kind of scenario?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure. I don't know that we had any concerns necessarily going in, besides maybe there had been some concerns that volunteers would not be able to show up or would not choose to show up due to the snow and the very cold weather. And I am excited to say that all of our volunteers showed up as scheduled to help us so that we're able to get an accurate count. Because every year, that's what we're trying to do, is get as accurate a count as possible.
And you've talked about literal homelessness. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Absolutely. That's essentially another HUD-coined term. So oftentimes we'll have folks who are experiencing homelessness but are able to what we call couch surf. So maybe they're staying on one friend's couch for a week and then maybe they're staying somewhere else for another week and kind of having to bounce around a bit. While that still certainly identifies as is homeless, we are specifically for this count looking for that literal homeless individual, someone who is either having to stay in a shelter or who is staying on the streets in this weather.
So what did you see last night as a group of both volunteers and professionals trying to get this snapshot in time?
Interestingly, so far what we found, so again, to be clear, we're still in the middle of
right,
the count.
Yes.
And interestingly, and I find a little bit discouragingly, is we have already found more folks living on the streets this year than we did last year. And it was 55 degrees last year. So the fact that we're finding, so far we found 377 folks who identified as living on the streets last night.
And how many of those people were without any shelter, including a homeless shelter? 377.
Precisely.
Oh, exactly. My gosh. I mean, with the weather, I just trying to brave these particular elements, that's really harrowing to me. Mm-hmm. Can you explain more about the stories of people you encountered or how they were attempting to stay warm? What was going on?
That's a good question. It really varies. A lot of those folks are folks who were in warming shelters at the time. So at the time, they were in a warm, safe space with the understanding that
during the day.
Correct. Or even, you know, into the evening hours with the understanding that once those doors closed, they'd be going back out into the cold. We did luckily yesterday end up having a lot of blankets donated. So we were able to distribute those at the count yesterday, which was certainly a great blessing to have as well.
I mean, do you know of any cases from these last 24 hours of health crises, frostbite, hypothermia?
Surprisingly, not so far. We have not heard any reports of that, though I wouldn't be surprised if we start hearing back from volunteers that something similar like that was happening, but not so far.
Obviously, you have not had time to analyze what you saw last night. This whole point in time is still in session.
Correct.
But has anything so far stood out to you besides just this surprising detail that there were more people mm-hmm. sleeping without shelter in Kansas City last night than a year ago on a day on a night when it was in the 50s?
Mm-hmm. So far, I would say that that's, of course, the biggest thing that has stood out. Being halfway through it, we're still kind of trying to pull all the data together. What will happen is we're doing an electronic survey this year, which helps us get access to that data much faster. So the good news is very soon we'll be able to pull a more educated view of what those numbers are showing us.
Can you give me a picture of this time of year and what it means for Kansas City's homeless population in general? Just cold weather, winter time.
I think it looks like a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But just as you mentioned this morning, trying to even imagine what it's like staying outside in any capacity, even with some kind of windbreak, even with other folks, it truly boggles the mind what that must be like and how mentally that has to wear someone down, let alone physically.
You know, it was too cold for kids to wait outside for school buses yesterday. It was too cold for mail carriers to deliver mail in certain hours of the day. What is your sense of how communities attempt to sleep outside? Can you tell me what you know about that?
In my experience, groups is usually a way to help stay safer. So often in my experience, when we meet with folks, there's usually a group of folks that then hopefully have tents, have some kind of ways to stay warm, hand warmers, propane tanks, propane heaters. Those are all things. We've got a very strong volunteer community here who help provide those things to our homeless neighbors. But obviously, it's still no substitute for permanent housing.
How do organizations providing resources adapt to a cold spell like this? Are there ways for them to help beyond what they normally do?
That's a great question. I would imagine that a lot of that is going to come down to donations. It's going to come down to, again, kind of communication with the community and letting folks what is needed, know what's needed to help serve those clients. And it's boils down to asking the clients as well and asking our homeless neighbors what are their particular needs and then finding ways to meet those.
What is it about this whole situation that, from your perspective, tends to go unnoticed, misunderstood, like the level of nuance that your organization is trying to understand homelessness in? Maybe can you transmit some of that?
So if I'm understanding your question, a couple of things that we're that we've been doing, we've been analyzing last year's point in time count data as we've been pulling in data this year. We've kind of been, of course, comparing the last year and this year, as you've seen already. And so we're, in terms of nuances, we're trying to pay attention to understanding the stories behind the folks, behind these numbers, really understanding the stories that's going on here so we can get to how to truly end homelessness. So for instance, about last year's number indicate that about a third of the homeless folks who spoke to us last year were experiencing homelessness for the first time. So those kind of pieces of information help us understand how to best address the needs of our community.
I want to talk to someone who had to navigate all of this herself last night, a woman who wants to go by first name only because of the sensitivity of her current situation. She is dealing with homelessness right now. She has been traveling from city to city, and she landed in Kansas City last week, I believe.
Yes, ma'am. Yep.
Hi, I would like to introduce Danny. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Gino. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about what the last couple of days have been like for you.
Extremely hard work. We work really hard to survive on the streets. So people think that we're lazy or, that we just don't want to get a job type of thing. And I speak for everybody, I think, when I say that that is not true. We work really hard. It's a 24-hour job. And
surviving.
Absolutely, yes. It's much harder than it looks by far.
How, in your experience, I mean, if you don't mind my asking, where have you been sleeping? How have you been getting by? What are maybe some routes you have tried and come up against obstacles with?
Well, I think it just depends on, like, location, you know? If you're in a warm area, it's a lot easier to move around. I walked from Omaha to Des Moines, and...
How long of a walk is that?
It took me about a week and a half, but I did couch surf a couple times in between, like Heather was saying. But finding a place to rest is one of the hardest things for us to do, you know? And I kind of actually just pieced together what was going on last night because I realized that nobody was in the usual spots, quote unquote, that they normally frequent at night. And we find some spaces for a couple hours and then we get kicked out and then we move to the next space, you know? But a lot of times security guards and the law enforcement won't bother us. But last night, I told one of my companions, seems like they're doing a sweep or something. What's going on? And now I realize that it was this thing that you're describing, Heather. So, but we don't have a right to rest.
So people weren't in their usual spots last night?
No, it's been a ghost town. And I was actually going to ask you, Heather, is your company working with law enforcement to do these counts?
Yes, absolutely. That's a good question. And we work with law enforcement both on the Kansas side and on the Missouri side. They are very gracious in that they understand that that can be sort of a turnoff if you're seeing police officers and cars showing up to certain places where folks usually stay. So often they will kind of hang back while our group of volunteers will then go out into the places where they usually are able to find folks.
Okay, yeah.
But so... Last night, was it hard to find? I mean, we just heard from Heather
we couldn't sit anywhere in our usual spots. Like, there's a lot of different spots around the city, countless actually, where, you know, we'll sit and rest, you know, for a few hours. Law enforcement, security officers, and everybody in between were kind of doing sweeps and shooing us out, which I mean, I've only been in the city a week and a half, but it doesn't take long to, you know, kind of get the gist of everything. And I had never seen that before, so I thought it strange and kind of put it all together now.
But I guess my question for you is, if staying together is part of what makes safety a little...
No, not necessarily, no. You travel in a large group and you draw attention to yourself. And, you know, there's a lot of bickering. Being homeless and especially being homeless in the cold makes people hardened. You know, we're irritable and we just want to rest our eyes. And we can't do that anywhere. You know, not even a establishment that's open during the day. So, you know, we end up like bickering amongst ourselves. But we're resilient, though. We're super strong. And you were talking about how mentally... it's a challenge, and absolutely, it's a huge mental challenge, and makes you mentally stronger, you know, not weaker, if you're able to survive.
Can you, did you consider or look into the possibility of a shelter?
I did, yes. I had a really negative experience at a shelter back in Michigan. I was in a shelter for 3 or 4 days, and it was my first shelter I'd ever been to, and I watched a woman beat her child to a pulp, and she was a young mother, didn't know better. She's been raised in that system, and she probably didn't have any type of mentor to teach her that she was not, she shouldn't, you know, take her anger out on her child. Frustration and hunger and, you know, poverty is going to do that to women, and I couldn't take it. And I arrived at the shelter in a different city, and it was the same type of thing. Babies crying nonstop. And if you've ever sat and listened to a baby cry for hours, I would rather be out in the cold and have to chop my fingers off from, you know, frostbite. It's one of the worst sounds I could hear. So I choose not to stay in a shelter. And, you know, that's...
Even with this cold?
Yes, absolutely. I went to a place that was supposed to help me with a shower, emergency clothes, food. And I went up to the woman that was at the desk. I said, "Hi, my name's Danny. You know, I'm new in town. Happy New Year." And she bit my head off and yelled at me because I asked what time the showers were. And she was very off-putting. And I started crying and I walked out. So a lot of the places that you go to for help, these people are hardened as well. So it's just a vicious cycle of, you know, irritability. And, you know, we need some jokes. I think we need jokes, some comedy in our lives. To,
oh, man.
You know,
I wish I had come prepared with one, but I did not. I'm sorry. Well, can you, you know, you spoke about moving from place to place. Can you tell me more about that as part of, like, how that works, what that looks like for you in Kansas City and maybe as opposed to other places?
It's kind of the same in every place as far as you have to keep moving, you know. If you're smart and you are observant, you can't stay and linger in one place too long, because if you take a look around your city, any city in America, there's these signs and they say, "No loitering." And they mean it. But at the same time, I've been in the city a week and a half, and I've had many interactions with security guards and people who are supposed to keep track of that loitering thing. And all my interactions have been super positive with law enforcement and security guards. I feel like if you are minding your P's and Q's a little bit and you show these guys a little respect, it goes a long way, and they'll treat you with the same respect. So,
it sounds like last night was exceptionally challenging, not just because of the cold.
Horribly challenging. It was definitely a new thing for me, definitely. I've never felt anything like the cold I felt in my fingers. Around 4 or 5 in the morning, I almost started crying for sure. I felt a weak moment.
What do you do to try and stay warm in those moments?
As much as I don't like traveling with other people, in every city I find some travel companions, and I have a really amazing travel companion that has showed me around the city, kind of kept me safe, and you know, I look to him. I look to my comrades, you know, and a companionship, human connection. I feel like that warms you up inside and therefore gets you through those cold nights.
What do you want people listening right now to understand about being homeless in this city right now?
That they'll never understand us. They'll never, you can't understand. And, you know, don't look at us like, you know, we're on the other side of the window. Open the window and talk to us, because we're just like you.
You know, we're going to be talking to someone who runs a shelter in just a minute. Is there anything you want us to ask him on your behalf when we pick this conversation back up?
Yes. We wrote a list of demands, and we brought them with us, and we would like showers. And we also would like a dance party. So if we could talk about that, that'd be great.
Dance party. Can you explain more? I understand the shower part.
I just want everybody to have a good time. I noticed that in this city, especially in this city, and I think it's because it's so cold, it's the time of year, that all of the street kids and the homeless community are very hardened. Nobody smiles. You know, everybody's tired and weary for many different reasons, countless reasons, you know, and that's not for me to point out what their reasons are, but... I feel like a dance party and some balloons would cheer everybody up.
Danny, thank you so much for sharing your story. I am really glad that you've come in to talk with us, and I'm really glad that you've gotten to warm up in here, too.
Thanks a bunch for having me. I really appreciate it, Gina.
Thank you. We will hear from City Union Mission in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're going to continue this conversation about how Kansas City's homeless are weathering the frigid cold, including what they're seeing in shelters and gaps in services for folks on the street. Call 816-235-2888 with your concerns. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I'm talking with Heather Hoffman of the Kansas City Coalition to End Homelessness. We've been hearing that their point in time survey is going on right now, capturing a real-time picture of Kansas City's homeless population over what happens to be an exceptionally cold 24 hours. Hi again, Heather.
Hello.
And Heather, we're going to introduce our next guest in a moment, but I was surprised to hear from Danny, the woman who's experiencing homelessness right now, who just visited with us and shared her experience of the last couple days in Kansas City, that people might not have been where they usually were overnight last night, maybe in part because of the point-in-time survey trying to get an accurate picture of homelessness here.
It was an interesting perspective. I found that very helpful. Typically, what we try to do is let folks know well in advance. We try to have the outreach workers let folks know who are staying outside that they will be seeing more activity than usual on a certain night. We even have posters and flyers that we put up.
So you're not trying to, like, keep this a secret?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
It's interesting. We're joined now by Reverend Dan Doty. He's the executive director of City Union Mission. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Good to be here.
What are you seeing right now? And I guess I'd like you to start by responding to some of what you just heard from Danny, including that the people in her community would like showers and a dance party.
Well, thankfully, we can say we have not a dance party per se, but we have groups that come in for fun nights in our shelters, and we have showers that are available for everyone. So those things, you know, in some cities are harder to come by, but boy, in Kansas City, there are provisions for that kind of thing.
So explain to me what's been going on from your perspective over the last couple of nights.
Well, our numbers have increased. We still have a lot of space for men.
Empty beds.
Empty beds, yeah.
What are the criteria for people to be able to use those beds?
Coming in cooperative, primarily that more than anything. There's an outside area for people who smoke and times that they can go out, which is most of the time until it's bedtime, and then we don't allow people to go out to smoke. We don't allow alcohol use or drug use in the facilities. If someone, because it's a community staying together, we have to be careful for everyone. So people who sometimes want to come in and do their own rules would then disturb those who want peace and order. So it's a fine line sometimes in working with people. But we have lots of space for men. The family situation is different. Our family shelter is almost perpetually full. But we have opened in the last couple of nights extra space and even one large space in a gymnasium that we have.
Where do I was just going to ask where you find extra space.
Yeah, well, we use we have a nursery facility that it's not used at night overnight, so we open the nursery. We have a classroom that is used for overflow. We have actually have an overflow room. It's used during the day for just a lounge for people to stay in. But those places all get full. I don't think we've had to use the gymnasium yet. And that was a surprise because we've definitely heard we were prepared because of the cold.
With 377 people still sleeping outdoors as of the best count that people could get last night, is it surprising to you that you have this space that isn't being used? How do you account for that?
Well, in previous years, in our men's shelter, we have 300 beds set up. And so we had 220 last night in that facility, so 80 empty beds. Plus, we have another 50 to probably 75 mattresses that we can put in other areas. We've had a few years ago as high as 377 stay in the men's shelter. There are a couple of factors. There are more people getting work and getting apartments and things like that, so that's a good thing. We're seeing an increased number in our long-term program for homeless men. And we also, a year ago, opened a facility next to our men's shelter that is for men with mental health or physical challenges. And so some of the men that typically were in our emergency shelter are now in our special care facility.
I guess what I mean is, you know, there are negative temperatures and negative wind chills, and people are sleeping outside when there are empty shelter beds. And I'm curious what your interpretation of that is.
Okay, yeah. Danny is very sharp, without question. And hopefully she'll continue to be that and be safe and strong. But most of us understand that living outside, especially year-round, has all kinds of impacts, health-wise, even mental health. And so, there are a lot of people that just refuse to go into a facility of any kind, even though, we feel like ours is a very friendly place. But it, again, the men's shelter in particular has a lot of people, a lot of different personalities. And as Danny was saying, in our family shelter, we do have families. We have
families
moms.
Come with specific kinds of noises, no matter
yes, they do.
Where you are.
And different levels of parenting skills and that kind of thing. So we teach about 20 different life skills in our family center that will help people. But back to your question, it really is, from what we've heard from people, it's more the rules and not wanting to have anyone say, you must be in at this time, you have to go to bed at this time, our meals are at this time.
Why does that strike you as like a necessary set of regulations?
Just for order. Again, There are shelters in the country that are, I guess some of them are called low barrier or no barrier. We feel that ours is definitely a low barrier, but if it were a no barrier, we feel like, that would exclude a lot of people that come for peace and for safety. And with a lot of the mental health issues that we see just growing rapidly, there has to be order.
I'm curious, you've been talking about the men's shelter and making that distinction between the situation there and in the family shelters. Can you talk about some of the differences in the resources and approaches to providing resources, depending on everything from age to gender to whether you're a single person dealing with homelessness or trying to get through it as a family?
Well, I'm not sure I know how to directly answer the question, but definitely differences. In our family shelter, a person can stay initially for 2 weeks, and if they are working with case manager on the issues that have brought them to homelessness, that continues. They're able to stay, and we encourage those in the emergency shelter at the family center to consider our long-term program because they have a longer period of time to get stable and strong and reestablish relationships and things like that. And just to continue to learn some life skills that, you know, most of us learned growing up ourselves from parents, but so many of the people that we work with didn't have those same benefits that many of us had.
Can you jump in here, Heather? Just on this distinction between what is available to one population but may not be available to another, and why, and how a community attempts to fill those gaps.
I'm trying to process the question because it's definitely multifaceted. I think Dan and I are both kind of trying to find ways to articulate it. Absolutely, I've always said, you know, if you find 377 folks who are experiencing homelessness, they're going to have probably 400 different reasons of why. So our whole goal as an agency is to help other agencies in the community address each of those individual reasons to help those folks get what they need individually to be able to get back to finding sustainable housing for themselves and or their families.
I guess just that distinction, though, between what happens at men's shelters, what mm-hmm. happens at women's shelters, family shelters, like...
Dan and I are staring at each other.
What I'm trying to figure out is whether there are gaps in services for some communities, in spite of we're hearing about extra beds in a men's shelter, but we're also hearing about full facilities for families.
That makes sense. So in terms of gaps, that's actually something that we're trying to work on right now and do a gaps analysis over the next year to help us determine where those gaps are coming from and help us understand if what we're seeing anecdotally really does translate into hard data once we do a gaps analysis. We certainly, when it comes to families, interestingly, often when we go through our list and we have a place in the community that has a permanent housing spot open for families, often we can't always find a family to fill it right away. So sometimes we get conflicting data about whether or not what the actual need is in the community. So we're bringing some outside sources in to help us identify that.
One of the greatest needs, I mentioned we have a facility for men with mental health or physical handicaps, and there's no question there's a desperate need for the same thing for single women. And that's something that we're looking at, but it's not a quick and easy fix. But that's a serious gap in our opinion, because we have so many in our family shelter that, you know, crying babies are one thing, but individuals that have serious mental health issues is another major need to be solved. So that's something we're looking at.
You know, Heather, is it your sense, looking at who was out there last night, that single women and people who might be in need of mental health resources do account for a lot of the people who were out there last night without shelter?
I can't speak as well to last night as I can simply to our experience over the last, you know, year and a half of collecting data regularly from agencies. And the answer to that is yes. We absolutely feel that there are a lot of studies that tell us that there's a lot of folks experiencing mental health issues on the streets. And frankly, I think just being on the streets is something that's going to make it a lot harder to address that, and is more likely to help increase that mental health, those incidences of mental health illness.
And what about the single women piece of it in Kansas City?
I'm just not sure that I can speak to that with hard data to be able to respond to that in a way that I was confident in what I had to say. But it's absolutely something that we'll be paying attention to as we pull these numbers together.
Heather Hoffman of the Kansas City Coalition to End Homelessness, Dan Doty, Reverend Dan Doty of City Union Mission, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Keep talking about this on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. There's more Central Standard to come in just a minute. Stay tuned. We're back. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we're switching gears and turning our attention to the Glor Psychiatric Museum in St. Joseph. They've got an event this weekend. It's a ghost hunt. And this is the first that I have heard of any rumor that this museum might be haunted. But I think that people's fascination with this place does have to do with something both haunting and humanizing about the exhibits there and how close they make you feel to real people who lived in what is now a museum when it was what they would have called an asylum or hospital for what they would have called the insane. Mm-hmm. Here to tell some of those stories is Sarah Elder. She's a curator there, and she'll be sharing these stories not as ghost stories, but as human stories. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. Can you tell me, just for people who have never been there, explain what the Glore Psychiatric Museum is?
Well, the Glore Psychiatric Museum was designed by George Glore, founded by George Glore, as a way to not only tell the history of the treatment of the mentally ill, but also the history of the State Lunatic Asylum No. 2, which was the original name of the psychiatric care facility in St. Joseph. So that's our goal. And George's main goal was to help destigmatize mental illness, to illustrate that this is what mental illness is, the different things that can affect the brain, and also to realize to get people to understand it better. And
there also seems to be a journey through some what we would now, I think, largely see as mistaken approaches to either understanding or treating mental illness.
Yes, there we have a staff member who sometimes refers to the museum to some ideas that didn't work, because really it was just a simple case of not understanding how the brain works, and we're constantly learning how the brain works. It was fairly recent in both medical science and just history that people believed that we only used 10% of our brain. Well, now I know. No, we use our entire brain, just not all of it all the time. You know, it just kind of varies. So it's that kind of a history. And then, yeah, there are treatment devices that to our 21st century eyes are absolutely horrific, but they really were doing the best they could with the knowledge they had at the time.
Yeah, there are tools for treatment on display with yes. text that kind of explains what the thinking behind it was at the time. And that stuff is both super disturbing and also really enlightening. But there are also things there that people who lived in this, what they at the time called asylum, mm-hmm. things that people who lived there made. And I think that those things are really incredible because they can really give you a window into a person's very specific internal world.
Yeah, they are amazing. Art therapy has long been a treatment for the mentally ill, and some of the pieces of artwork that we have are amazing. I am not an artist. So, you know, just looking at some of these things, as I tell people, my stick figures don't even look like stick figures. So I am just amazed. And we have beautiful landscapes and beautiful still life, but we also have things that, as part of art therapy, they were, you know, create a paper mache mask as to how you see yourself. So some of these masks are, they look like monsters, or because it was just a therapy, and then the therapist could work from that. Or there's one, it's one of my favorites. It's a piece of clay, and it's just simply a mouth with a tongue sticking out. And basically, this young man was sick and tired of feeling sick and tired. So he was just kind of, bleh. You know, we've all had that feeling. But he was sick of that. So that was his expression at that point.
There are also quilts.
Yes, we do have embroidery. We have quilts, beautiful quilts. One piece, well, not quite a quilt. It's a sheet of embroidery. And it was a woman. And because of privacy laws, even we at the museum don't know who these patients were exactly. We know it was a young woman. She suffered from schizophrenia, and she didn't really communicate much until a nurse gave her a pillowcase and a needle and embroidery thread, and she just started embroidering words, phrases, thoughts, and she'd fill it up, they'd get rid of it, they'd give her another one, till finally, early 70s, the museum got one piece. We don't know how many she totally did, but we have, and it's things from whiskey, wine, beer, hair on fire, wait for me, I'm lonely, when are you coming for me, to you better watch out, you better not pout, Santa Claus is coming to town. So there's all these phrases, and for years there was the belief that this was just randomness. This is just, you know, the thoughts in her head, the voices in her head, the things are going around her. Well, several years ago we had a student from I believe it was Millikan University, came in, he and his instructor studied it, and realized that, no, this, she's communicating. She's telling us things, and it was up to us to figure out what she was trying to say. And he wrote an article on it. It was called Analysis of a Silent Voice, which we have copies of at the museum as handouts. So it's just fascinating, the things that we learn constantly.
What was his understanding of what she might have been trying to communicate?
I'm going to be honest, I didn't get a chance to reread it to refresh my mind. So I do apologize to your listeners for not having that, but give us a call. We'll send you the article.
Well, the object that really captivated me initially on my first visit, and one that I think about a lot, even years after the first time I saw it, it's a TV. It is an old TV, like the boxy kind.
Yes.
So not a flat screen, but this sort of an object with depth.
Yes.
And it's got vents in the side. I don't know
of
if
course.
You remember this kind of TV.
Exactly, yeah.
But a resident had been putting notes in those vents trying to send a message to the outside world. Can you tell that story? I guess the thinking had been that if the TV can bring messages from the outside world in to the hospital, then it could also maybe bring a message from inside the hospital out to the world.
Right. It's sometimes referred to as the television diary or the boxcar letters, simply because he writes a lot about a boxcar. But it was a patient who was seen putting pieces of paper in the back of the TV. And of course, now, again, this goes back to not a lot of people, our tours, our school groups, our high school and college students, and many of them don't recognize the big console TVs with the vents and how hot they actually got on the inside. So the fact that this thing never caught fire was amazing. But employees immediately unplugged it, took it apart, and they found over 500 notes and letters that he'd stuffed inside. And he really was communicating or trying to communicate with the outside world in that, you know, communication, television shows, news programs, commercials come out of the TV, so he could just send communication through the TV. And he wrote about different things, about boxcars, he wrote about politics, and it didn't have to be a blank piece of paper, a magazine, any paper he would write on.
You know, so the TV is displayed with the notes kind of on the wall next to it.
Yes, and some of them.
Some of them. Mm-hmm. And I seem to remember he had kind of this recurring message, like you said, about a boxcar, but that he thought maybe that it seemed to me that he had some awareness that something wasn't working in his mind, because he was saying that his knowledge had been taken by this particular boxcar and he wanted someone to bring it back.
Yeah, something that, or he would refer to that, the knowledge had been taken by the boxcar, or he would refer to the boxcar had all of his money in it and he couldn't get to it. And the boxcar was down on the railroad tracks down by the river in St. Joe. So there was what I do know of him, that he was diagnosed as delusional, paranoid. But again, like I said, there was something about a boxcar, and I don't know, excuse me, maybe he was a railroad employee at one point. It's pure speculation on our part. There's something about the boxcar, whether it was his knowledge or money, it just depended on which letter, which note you're reading.
What are some of the lesser known stories of patients or just objects that don't get a ton of attention that have stuck with you as someone who really knows this collection and spends a lot of time with it?
Well, there is a small display of ceramics that were done by a young man who he had gone on vacations with his family, or he would see things, travel logs on television, and he created these different things of different aspects in it of traveling, one of which is, it could be either way. It looks like the arch in St. Louis, but it's also painted yellow. So it could be a McDonald's arch. It could be the Gateway Arch in St. Louis. But there's just a Capitol building. There's these little tiny figures that look like little monsters, one of which is holding a knife. And he created that one because he saw a horror movie called Trilogy of Terror. And this is one of the characters that's in there. So he created this as kind of a catharsis to get it out of his, kind of get it out of his system. My favorite of his pieces, though, is that he went to the dentist. And he hadn't been taking care of his teeth. And the dentist, in a matter of frustration, said, look, if you don't start taking better care of your teeth, we're going to have to pull them and you're going to have to wear dentures. Well, he thought about that. So he went back and in ceramics, he created his own set of dentures, which is a fine idea, except they're fairly small and they're kind of jagged like shark's teeth. But he did. He created his own set of dentures. And a lot of people do tend to glance at them without reading the label and just kind of pass them by. And I enjoy those because that's his work and his way of kind of dealing with things that he saw and just creating them for his own world.
And a solution.
Yes. Yeah. And he came up, he knew he's, okay, dentures, I'll just make my own. Not a problem. Not necessarily practical, but he created his own.
You know, one of the what I think is a more shocking display for a lot of people, and it does get a lot of attention. They're the metal objects that had to be removed from a patient's stomach mm-hmm. because she had swallowed them.
Yes.
They're the actual objects kind of arranged in this, like, swirl.
Yeah, they are the actual objects. It was a female patient who died in her sleep. And there was no obvious means of death, so she was taken to autopsy. And that is what the doctors found in her stomach. 1,446 items that she had swallowed. And it ranges, most of it's metal. There's a few porcelain buttons, some glass beads, bracelets, earrings. But most of it is nails, bolts, nuts, salt and pepper shaker tops, the handles of forks and spoons. And she was suffering from a disease called pica. And at its basic form, it's the uncontrollable urge to eat things that have no nutritional value. And for years, it was thought there was a nutritional imbalance. Now it is a diagnosis as a form of OCD. And it can take many forms. There's some of these called geophagia, which is eating dirt. There was a television show based around it called My Strange Addiction. So laundry detergent, chalk, hair. Those kinds of things can lead to, it leads to what is pica. But we don't know the exact cause of death, again, privacy laws, but we can surmise that she probably bled to death internally, because we're talking nails, nuts, bolts, lead, things that are in her stomach. And again, we don't know how long she'd been doing that before she passed away. And it was arranged, this is 1910. And it was arranged in, like you said, in this pattern, kind of a mandala pattern. And it's been at the hospital since 1910 and has been part of the museum. And it is the, when you're talking about things like that, you hesitate to use the word most popular, but it is. It is the one exhibit that everybody remembers, whether they were there 2 weeks ago or 30 years ago. It's like, do you still have that? Yes, it's still right upstairs on the second floor. It's a detail of which is a postcard, which is purchased as a memory, as a souvenir.
Do you, as someone who studies these objects and kind of interprets these stories and helps visitors make sense of them, what is it that you take from it as just what perspective do you have on all these stories as sort of like a collection?
Trying to adhere to George Glor's original mission. To destigmatize mental illness, to explore, to explain, and to get across to our visitors that yes, these do look horrific, but they did have a meaning at the time. And there's a phrase that we have just in a label on the wall, and I'll paraphrase. It was from Dr. Thomas Kirkbride, who was a psychiatrist in the 19th century, and it's a little thought-provoking in that it is everyone who has a brain is prone to mental illness as those who have lungs are prone to pneumonia. So it could happen to anybody.
What do you think of the idea that the Glor Psychiatric Museum might be haunted?
There's been some things that we can't explain. And we do get paranormal investigations. This weekend is Ghost Hunts USA, and you do book your tickets through them. They will be coming and going through a tour and investigating just to see, is there anything residual hanging around? Ghost Hunts has several things booked. We do our own Spend the Night in October. You can certainly get in touch with the museum for that, and that includes dinner and psychiatric investigation, paranormal investigation and a tour and all that kind of thing, too.
But do you think it's haunted?
And this is my opinion, so everybody take it for what it is. This is my opinion. They do not necessarily reflect the opinion of the rest of the staff. but yes, actually, I do. Simply because, like I said, there are noises that we just can't explain away. And for me, I hear wheels of carts. I hear conversations, footsteps, that kind of thing. So it's a little tough to say.
What conversations?
Oh, murmured conversations. I don't actually hear the words themselves, but I do hear, it's like, what is this? I hear people talking all the time from our visitors, and then it's like, we're not open yet. Where are these conversations coming from? So I'll go and look, and okay, nobody's there. All right, I'm just going to go back to my office and go back to work. I like to think that there are more things in heaven and earth that are met in our aspect. So that's kind of, I'm not quite a skeptic, but I do look for the actual cause of a noise before I was like, well, I can't come up with, okay, fine, moving on. I'm not sure.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. If you want to go on a ghost hunt, that is this weekend. It's this Saturday night at 8:15 at the Glore Psychiatric Museum. You can get more information on the museum's website if you think you want to check it out. Sarah Elder, thank you for joining us
today. Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much. And check out ghosthuntsusa.com.
Sarah is the curator of collections for the St. Joseph Museums, and she spoke with us about one museum in particular today. That's a wrap. You can listen back to anything from this morning's show, anything you might have missed, at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow is our first Friday Arts show. We'll be hearing about Paper Airplanes, an operatic send-up of Julia Child, and a Talking Heads cover band. That's tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. I ain't afraid of no ghosts.